Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we begin this week's coverage of the Triangle Business Journal with the Biz page. And under the heading Check It Out comes the article, Outdoor Office Looks to Lure People to the Warehouse District. The sidewalks under the Dillon Tower in downtown Raleigh are still sleepy, despite the spate of new openings in the neighborhood. Shoppers can now peruse the aisles at Urban Outfitters or get a $25 deluxe shave at Bishop's Cuts and Color. But most of the storefronts remain empty, including the offices and retail space at Union Station. It's definitely in that transition phase, but that transition is happening quickly, Downtown Raleigh Alliance Director of Events Chase Bryan says. His organization is trying to jumpstart pedestrian activity in what will likely soon be a new bustling corner of the city's core. The organization is hosting an outdoor office in the Union Station Plaza where workers can bask in the sun and sip free coffee while tapping on their laptops. The office is being hosted in partnership with Alfred Williams & Company, which provided furniture. The space is open through October 12th. So if you're stuck inside a gloomy office while the sun is shining, ask your boss to take the next meeting outside. And under the heading of Inside Look comes the article, Cure for Writer's Block Gets an International Audience. A Durham company, turning data into a narrative form, hosted students from Singapore on October 1st. Automated Insights Wordsmith platform turns structured information into stories, for example, taking a company's earnings report and producing a story for the Associated Press, and writing for AccuWeather, and even about fantasy football for Yahoo. That capacity raised the interest of Professor Christopher Cummings of Nanyang Technical University. He brought his teaching assistant and 12 students to Automated Insights, which has 78 employees, to learn more about Wordsmith as part of a recent trip to the Triangle. Our question is, hey, can you write biz next week? And under the heading of a cool event comes the article, Top Chefs Chip In for Hurricane Relief. Some of the area's culinary leaders will be convening at the Dillon in Raleigh on October the 7th for a come-together for the Coast event to raise money for Hurricane Florence relief. Chef Scott Crawford of Crawford & Son has partnered with the Sunday Supper on relief efforts to benefit small businesses. At the event, guests can taste signature dishes from some of the region's most prominent chefs, including Ashley Christensen of AC Restaurant Group, Vivian Howard of Chef and the Farmer, Vansana Nolintha of Vida Manda, Jake Wood of 18 Seaboard, Colin Bedford of Fearington House, and many more. Multiple breweries and distilleries are involved as well. The event will include music and a live auction. Tickets, $250 per person. And under the heading, Helping Out, the article, Storm-Torn Flags Become Hot Property After Florence. A flag whose image went viral as it was battered by Hurricane Florence off the North Carolina coast has been sold for $10,900. And its proceeds have been earmarked for the American Red Cross for hurricane relief. Felt like the right thing to do, says Richard Neal of Charlotte, who owns the Coast Guard station turned offshore getaway called the Frying Pan Tower off Bald Head Island. Now he plans to donate the one that flew during Hurricane Matthew. He doesn't know which charity he'll pick, but says it's something he might repeat for significant storms in the future. And on under the heading of On Display comes the article, He Made an Impact on the Field and on the Canvas. The name Ernie Barnes didn't immediately register with biz when rummaging through the old inbox recently. He must have been an important figure, though, if his life and legacy are being remembered in a series of events by the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission in Durham this weekend and next, right? Right, indeed. Turns out, Durham-born Barnes is an accomplished artist and former pro football player with the San Diego Chargers and Denver Broncos. And his painting, titled The Sugar Shack, is one of America's most iconic images. The work served as a cover art for Marvin Gaye's 1976 album I Want You and appeared in the opening and closing credits of the TV show Good Times, for 3 full seasons. The original painting is currently on display at the North Carolina Museum of History in downtown Raleigh as part of the exhibition, The North Carolina Roots of Artist Ernie Barnes. Another one of his works, In Rapture, was featured on the cover of a B.B. King album. And finally, from the biz page under the heading of New Perspective, comes the article, Chapel Hill Sees the World of Rock, Chalk, Jayhawk. The Tar Heels and Jayhawks have had plenty of basketball battles through the decades, but collaboration was the theme recently when the Chapel Hill Carrboro Chamber of Commerce visited Lawrence, Kansas. The September 23rd through 25th trip included 79 local business and government leaders who wanted to see how the business community in Lawrence interacts with the University of Kansas. Nathan Millian, the manager of Carr Mill Mall and member of the Chamber's Government Affairs Committee, notes that Lawrence and Chapel Hill Carrboro share the common bond of being university communities, but that Lawrence lacks the number of surrounding population centers that one has in the Triangle. But the trip, he says, showed an impressive bond between the university and business community. He calls the 85,000-square-foot Bioscience and Technology Business Center a collaboration between the university, local chamber, and local governments that opened in 2010 extremely interesting. They're taking research out of the university and putting it into companies, he says. They were incubating these companies. He says that's happening in Chapel Hill on a very, very small scale. It's being done with the Launch Chapel Hill program, but it's extremely small compared with what they are doing. It would be wonderful to have that kind of facility. The program featured multiple discussions and visits, but the overall theme, Chapel Hill Carrboro CEO Aaron Nelson says, was we saw what's possible when you think big and work together to achieve a shared vision for a community. Now we move to the tech and transportation page from this week's TBJ. And under the heading Inside the Deal comes the article, Keeping Amazon a Secret in Garner Was Tough for Officials. Hundreds of pages of emails and other records released by the town of Garner show major challenges in bringing Amazon's 1,500-job project to the former ConAgra site, from acquiring right-of-ways to managing time constraints to dodging inquiries from curious reporters. On December the 5th, Ryan Wilson, manager of economic development at Amazon, emailed Garner Economic Development Director Joseph Stallings, hoping we can chat for a few minutes tomorrow about a potential opportunity. The town scrambled to attention, with Stallings telling Ashley Cagle, Assistant Executive Director of Wake County Economic Development, and others about the project December the 14th, a move expected to bring between 1,500 and 2,000 jobs, he wrote at the time. The client made clear that the numbers they were giving to me were very conservative and are more than likely to increase, he wrote at the time. The project, which he didn't name, was looking in 3 other states. At the time, the plan was for it to take 60 acres. This would leave us about 30 acres to land another, hopefully higher-paying company, Stallings wrote. On May the 7th, just a week after the town had received updated site plans, Amazon's Wilson notified town and state officials of a serious time constraint. We have to start work and have the land development permit no later than July 1st, 2018, for the project to happen in North Carolina, Wilson wrote. We will do the best we can, Stallings wrote officials. On May the 10th, Stallings told Wilson the town was committed to meeting the timeline, and that it had even hired a special plan reviewer whose job is to solely focus on this project. The biggest challenge may have been keeping Amazon a secret for so many months, records show. Multiple emails were passed between officials with advice on how to handle media requests regarding the stealthy project. In June, Bill Anderson, town attorney, warned officials not to fall for the media's game and inadvertently confirm Amazon as the tenant. Some big development deals in the past have been killed by premature disclosure, a memo cautions. The project and its 1,500 jobs was announced August the 10th. And under the heading of Too Close comes the article, Close Calls Between Drones and Pilots Pick Up. The trend of close calls between flying robots and airplanes continues in 2018. On June 12th, a pilot headed down a runway at Raleigh-Durham International Airport alerted the tower that he spotted something about 120 feet below his plane. It was suspected to be a drone flying dangerously and illegally close to an aircraft. It's one of the 23 sightings in the second quarter of alleged unauthorized drones in North Carolina skies, documented in Federal Aviation Administration reports, more than double the 11 in the first quarter of 2018. Drones are not allowed near airports without permission, and the FAA prohibits most flying above 400 feet. Even so, FAA numbers show close calls between pilots and unmanned aerial vehicles have picked up across the nation, often at prohibited altitudes. In North Carolina, more than 26% of suspected sightings take place near RDU, data shows. Here are some from the second quarter. On June 22nd, a plane reported a drone near RDU at 8,500 feet. On June 14th, a helicopter at RDU spotted a drone and reported it to the tower. On June 12th, a pilot headed toward a runway at RDU reported something near his aircraft about 120 feet away. On June 5th, an aircraft spotted the same drone twice, just east of RDU. On May 14th, a pilot spotted a drone just south of RDU, but the tower could not observe any drone at the reported location. And on April 6th, while taxiing to the ramp, a pilot observed a quadcopter left of the taxiway at RDU. And under the heading Big Plans, the article Prometheus Group has an open checkbook to hire in Raleigh. A year after its first acquisition spree, one of Raleigh's fastest-growing companies is making more buys. Software company Prometheus Group, recently named among the 50 fastest-growing Triangle companies of 2018, announced on October the 2nd that it has acquired Ottawa-based Solify Information Technologies and Colorado-based DataSplice LLC in separate transactions. Finances were not disclosed. The move brings Prometheus to more than 300 employees, half of which are in Raleigh, says CEO Eric Huang. No layoffs are expected from the deals. We are definitely wanting to grow the business, and that additional growth will probably be in Raleigh, he says. There's basically an open checkbook when it comes to hiring in Raleigh right now. The goal is to add 30 people in Raleigh by the end of the year. But if we can find 50 people, that would be amazing, he says. And it's likely that space to accommodate those new employees will be an issue in 2019. He says the company is already talking about how to grow, and that will include either a new headquarters or additional office space elsewhere in Raleigh. Next, we turn to the real estate page of this week's TBJ. And under the heading of Modest Rents comes the article Chapel Hill Firm Buys North Hills Office Portfolio. A real estate investment firm based in Chapel Hill has closed on an office building portfolio in Raleigh's North Hills neighborhood, just inside the Beltline. Prudent Growth Partners bought four buildings on Barrett and Hayworth Drives for $12.2 million, acquiring 103,000 square feet of office space. To own several buildings like this inside the Beltline, all with rents that are very modest relative to most other buildings being built in North Hills, we think it's a great long-term hold, Prudent Growth Partners President Tom Hahn writes in an email. Our immediate plans are simply to continue to operate the buildings well and invest in some common sense improvements. Also, under the heading of Under Contract, comes the article, Changes may finally be coming for this dying mall. The lights burn dim in the empty hallways of the Prime Outlets Mall in Morrisville. The shop fronts and food court are vacant. Outside, fading signs advertise stores that have long since moved away. The parking lot's mostly empty, except for idling truckers and cab drivers. Businesses have been leaving the 25-acre shopping complex for years, despite attempts at revitalization by the mall's owner and the facility's location near Raleigh-Durham International Airport. Just one tenant remains, Epic at UNC, a training program for new employees in the UNC healthcare system. But change could be on the horizon. The 238,000-square-foot mall is under contract with an unnamed buyer. That's according to mall manager Cheswing Kung, who maintains an office just off the now-vacant food court. Despite the lack of shops and shoppers, Kung and his team keeps the mall's wooden hallway floors clean. Even the candy machines remain stocked with M&Ms and gumballs. The mall is owned by International Restaurant Management Group of Coral Gables, Florida. President Hoi Sang-yong declined to comment on the prospective buyer. His company bought the property in 2013 for $12 million after developers pitched a vision to transform the mall into an Asian-themed shopping center. Those plans never came to fruition. In the meantime, an entire wing of the mall has been sealed off, quarantined behind a walled-off hallway. Brittany Ireland, an IT trainer with Epic at UNC, says the mall is eerie, but likes the location and abundant parking. And continuing with this week's real estate pages, come under the heading of some holdouts, comes the article, Battle Continues Over Cameron Village Condos. An apartment developer is waiting in the wings to buy a valuable tract of land next to Raleigh's Cameron Village, if only the property's 51 owners could agree to sell. The Worthing Companies, based in Atlanta, is under contract to buy the property known as the Bellwood Condominiums, according to documents obtained by Triangle Business Journal. But for the sale to be finalized, every condo owner needs to agree to the deal. That hasn't happened just yet. In an email to condo owners, the Bellwood Condominium Homeowners Association Board said 15% of residents haven't committed to the sale. At stake is what could be one of the last major tear-down and redevelopment sites next to Cameron Village. The land is just under 5 acres and beside the Cameron Village Regional Library. The prospective sale comes on the heels of multiple maintenance problems at the 1940s-era condo community, including a $150,000 bill the HOA paid to repair a water leak after a lawsuit was filed by a homeowner. In the wake of that repair, an engineering study revealed another $675,000 of required improvements. A majority of the residents and landlords have been pushing to sell the property, but some residents have resisted. Attorneys from Manning Fulton, the law firm representing the Bellwood HOA, sent a letter September 24th to the Worthing Companies, seeking more time to get the remaining condo owners on board with the sale. Under the terms of the contract, the HOA now has until October the 9th. And under the heading of Big Investment comes the article, New York Firm Continues Triangle Push, Buys Largely Vacant Industrial Facility. The Indiana developer behind an industrial complex next to Research Triangle Park has finalized a deal to sell its last remaining project within the larger Triangle Business Park campus, a recently built 208,000-square-foot manufacturing and distribution facility. The sale marks the end of Indianapolis-based Scannell Properties investment in the park, which included building 7 warehouse facilities. Scannell Properties wrapped up construction on the latest building in July and completed a sale of the property last month, departing with the new facility for $17.24 million. The sale came despite the vast amount of space that remains vacant. At the time of the sale, the only tenant in the building was X Supply, a mechanical piping supply distributor with 81,000 square feet. Scannell Properties sold the facility to Gramercy Property Trust of New York, which owns more than 512,000 square feet of office and warehouse space in the Triangle. Scannell Properties Managing Director Bill Linville says the sale shows the demand in the Triangle for warehouse and industrial space that caters to more complex tenants, companies that often require technical finishes to buildings. And under the heading of Seeks Rezoning comes the article, Kane Pitches 20-Story Tower in Downtown Raleigh. The revitalization that has swept through Raleigh's warehouse district could soon cross the railroad tracks behind the city's new Union Station. Just across the tracks are the single-story offices of Clancy and Thays Construction, home to the company's headquarters since the 1970s. But Kane Realty Corporation, the developer behind the Dillon Tower, is pitching an ambitious plan to overhaul the property. The firm is under contract to buy the 6.8-acre plot of land and recently filed a rezoning application that would drastically alter this corner of the warehouse district. Kane is asking the city to allow up to 20 stories on a portion of the site, in addition to a mix of uses including residential, office, and retail. Current zoning classifies the land for lower density industrial uses with a height limit of 7 stories. Kane Realty Corporation CEO John Kane cites the growing activity in the district as the catalyst for his latest project. "We're 100% leased at the Dillon. The vacancy downtown is very low," he says. "The Dillon is 18 stories." Now we move to the health care of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and under the heading of New Space comes the article, RTI Celebrates Milestone with a $66 million headquarters. RTI International has begun the celebration of its 60-year anniversary, and it's doing so in a new $66 million headquarters. As the newest addition to the company, the six-story, 190,000-square-foot Horizons building will serve as its headquarters and workspace for about 670 employees. Chief Operating Officer James Gibson says the design to build the new headquarters was mostly driven by growth and the need for more facilities. The building was designed by Durham-based architecture firm Duda Payne to serve about 2,000 employees who work on RTI's campus. To do so, the first floor of the building has amenities such as a cafeteria, partially subsidized by the company, and a coffee shop that offers free beverages to all employees. The first floor also contains an interactive display of RTI's various projects and a gift shop for visitors and employees. The RTI-branded tumbler is the most popular purchase. The second floor of the building contains a myriad of open office suites, workspaces, conference rooms, and meeting spaces meant for employees to work remotely away from their desks. Also included on the second floor is the company's executive suite, which Gibson says was requested by CEO Wayne Holden so that top executives would be less removed from the employees and not nestled away on the top floor. The concept is something of a cultural change for the company. Previously, about 90% of assigned workstations were in closed offices. Now only about 60% of employees work in offices, many with transparent walls. Brad Washabaugh, RTI's Vice President of Facility Strategic Services, says the hope is to bring more of RTI's employees together by giving them more creative spaces and encouraging collaboration. And under the heading of Medicare comes the article, Six ACOs Exceed Savings Thresholds in North Carolina. In an industry where costs can be seen as ever-increasing, health care providers across North Carolina are finding ways to save Medicare patients and the government millions of dollars. Duke Connected Care, an integrated accountable care organization known as ACO, partnered with Duke Health. It recently announced that it saved Medicare $21.1 million in 2017, the most of any ACO in the state. The announcement is based on the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, that's known by the acronym CMS, their Medicare and Medicaid Services 2017 performance report, which showed just 6 of the state's 16 ACOs achieving cost savings beyond the program's required 2.5% savings threshold. ACOs are voluntary networks of hospitals and healthcare providers that coordinate care for Medicare patients. The goal is to optimize patient care, avoiding duplicate services and errors that result in lower costs and higher quality care. Those that exceed the 2.5% threshold share in the overall savings, receiving a portion of the shared funding. Duke's return for their savings totaled $9.8 million. ACO executives say regardless of whether an ACO exceeds the standard threshold, patients are receiving higher quality care and saving money. Debbie Huter, executive director at Wake Med Key Community Care, says the 25,600 patients covered by their ACO receive more personal, affordable care because of its efforts. She says though they did not exceed the 2.5% threshold last year, they still saved the required 2.5%, which within itself is an important feat. She says much of the individual year's savings have to do with the CMS benchmark. In 2017, Duke's benchmark was determined at $10,544, whereas Wake Med's was $7,511. Now, with this article, there are ACOs that exceeded the CMS saving threshold, and the list is Duke Connected Care in Durham, Chess MSSP LLC in High Point, the Coastal Plains Network in Greenville, the Coastal Carolina Quality Care in New Bern, Sand Hills Accountable Care Alliance in Fayetteville, and Pinehurst Accountable Care Organization in Pinehurst. Now here's a small snippet from the restaurants and retail page under the heading of third location, and the article is Crawford to open new steakhouse in Cary. Chef Scott Crawford has announced his third restaurant under Crawford Hospitality. The new restaurant called Crawford Brothers is set to open in 2020 at Cary's new Fenton development. The 92-acre mixed-use development will be anchored by Wegmans Food Market, as well as a 36,000-square-foot boutique theater. We have tapped Chef Scott Crawford as our North Carolina-based chef to anchor Fenton's culinary direction, said Dotan Zuckerman of Columbia Development. The development has also lured Atlanta chef Ford Fry, who will open a restaurant called Superica. Crawford, who last worked in Cary when he was the executive chef at the Umstead Hotel and Spa, says he's happy to have ties to the town again. I liked my time in Cary, and this development, Fenton, has great vision, he says. So I went with my gut, opening my third location there. Crawford Brothers will be a classic American steakhouse, focused on in-house beef aging. We also want to create a lounge with its own identity, Crawford says. We want you to come for the experience, even if you just come to dine in the lounge. The 4,500-square-foot restaurant will open in Phase 1 of Fenton's development and will feature an extensive selection of wines and cocktails. Crawford says the wine program will deliver a much larger list of wine than you'll find at any of his other restaurants. To help with the program, Crawford is bringing in his general manager from Crawford & Son to serve as the new beverage director at Crawford Brothers. Columbia's Zuckerman says landing Crawford was big for the rising development. We are committed to curating a mix of best-in-class-driven restaurants at Fenton. Scott Crawford, Ford Fry, and several others yet to be announced certainly fit the bill, he says. Crawford has earned 5 James Beard Foundation semifinalist nominations. He's in the process of opening his second restaurant, Jolie. The restaurant, named after his daughter, has hit a few snags due to permits and is now set to open in early 2019. Now we come to this week's cover story, which is entitled Miracle in Durham, Assembling 1,500 Airplane Engines with One Manager. The huge steel barrel resting on the platform is getting ready for takeoff. Someday, hundreds of components, meticulously placed, screwed, and pinned into place, will help the device soar. The massive combustion cylinder will suck in air, compress it, and inject fuel, sparking the engine and pushing the airplane that will surround it to the sky. The jets, branded by carriers such as Frontier, Southwest, and Delta, will rise off the runway, noses pointed to the clouds. To the hundreds of passengers on board, it will be just another flight. But for the 360 technicians working for General Electric's aviation unit in Durham, and whose job it is to make sure those engines can carry them home, it's a miracle. A year ago, there were 8 bays pushing out the workhorse engines called CFMs. 3 years ago, at the line's peak, teams in this building were loading 30 cores, that is, the critical center components of an engine, per week onto trucks, bound for assembly factories. Today it's 12, as the team winds down the line in preparation for what's coming next. It's awesome when I'm sitting in that aircraft, says Steve Sabin, a 25-year GE Aviation veteran in Durham. I look around and I'm like, they have no idea. GE Aviation, a business expected to generate more than $30 billion in revenue this year, houses its Durham engine manufacturing campus on a massive 500-acre campus, hidden by a long paved driveway from Miami Boulevard. But while the plant may have a low profile in the region, The aviation sector is a critical revenue driver for once-proud General Electric, a company whose stock has plummeted amid rising debt and diminishing profit. CEO John Flannery was ousted on October 1st as GE looks for a way forward after the glory years under Jack Welch, who retired in 2001. For the plant's general manager, Tom Bradley, it's a high-pressure job that is only about to intensify as the way engines are made is changing. To compete, GE Aviation has to change with it. Bradley says he's always waiting on the call, where higher-ups ask him, yet again, to add planes to his monthly production milestones. To him, it's not just about the Durham plant. It's also about the world. There are two companies, Boeing and Airbus, he says. That's really it. The engine business makes up about 90% of GE Aviation's revenue, Bradley estimates, and it's divided into three segments, military, commercial, and services. In Durham, it's all about commercial, massive engines for giant planes that will someday speed down a runway. What we are is a commercial jet engine assembly shop, he says. Components, big and small, are shipped either directly here or to a warehouse in Kentucky where they are fitted for transport to Durham. They come here, 6 deliveries a day, 6 18-wheelers a day, full of jet engine parts, he says. Last year, the company did more than 1,600 units. This year, it will be more than 1,500 as the factory shifts focus to newer engines. The Durham site makes 6 models of jet engine, including the CFM powering a traditional 737. It's like the Honda Accord of the jet engine, he says. It's really reliable. There's like a zillion of them. But with its partners, GE has reimagined the engine, he says. Now it's all about the engine called the Leading Edge Aviation Propulsion, or LEAP. That's the fastest growing commercial engine in the world, with 14,000 on order. It's a great forecast for us, Bradley says. I would like Durham to be done with CFMs. On LEAPs, we want to get to 25 a week. We're at 20 a week right now. As the CFM tapers down, his team expects to push out 600 LEAP engines for Boeing, and the pressure is on. Boeing will actually order more LEAPs from us if they could, but we can't produce them fast enough, he says. In the other of 2 production facilities at the site, the company is starting to produce the largest, most powerful jet engine in the world, Bradley says, the GEnx. In recent months, GE has made major changes to accommodate what's coming. GE transitioned production of its Passport engine, used in the Bombardier jets, and CF-34-8s, used in Bombardier CRJ jets and Embraer E-jets, to Kansas. Work on the CF-6 engine, that's the Boeing 747, Boeing 767, Airbus 8300, and others, moved to Ohio. And work will soon transition on the CFM-56, used in both legacy Boeing 737s and Airbus 320s. That work is also moving to Ohio. In their stead, crews are focusing more and more of their attention on LEAP and GE9X. The LEAP, produced by CFM International, a joint venture between GE Aviation and Safran Aircraft Engines, powers single-aisle jetliners and is targeting Boeing and Airbus planes previously fueled by the CFM-56. The GE9X will one day power Boeing's 777XSs. They'll also continue work on the largest engines, GEnx, which powers the Boeing 787 and 747-8, replacing the CF-6 model. We have GE's newest commercial engines here in Durham, Bradley says. All the jobs are created equal. The transition requires more than a complete equipment overhaul. It requires seasoned personnel, and it also requires time, particularly as the team figures out the nuances of the giant engine. That's where GE's other Durham innovation comes in, its non-traditional style workforce. It's a self-directed worksite. There's no management here other than me, he says. One manager and roughly 360 technicians report directly to Bradley, who considers himself more coach than boss in the traditional sense. They're divided into production work teams, each of which has written its own manual of sorts for constructing their tasks. There are 3 tech levels, but those don't necessarily mean your capability, he says. All the jobs here are created equal, Bradley says, noting that levels Tech 1, Tech 2, and Tech 3 are more along the lines of leadership and engagement at the facility. This whole place is like no other place you've been on the planet, he says. It's all run by the people who work here, and that includes scheduling. We flex around material availability, Bradley says. They schedule their own overtime. Flexibility allows crews to speed up production to meet deadlines, but it's employee drive that ensures owners are filled, he says. One employee is 25-year GE veteran Scott Gulledge, who left a job at American Express to do this. Gulledge says people who like to tinker, such as him, find success in the unusual culture here. Gulledge learned to problem solve while working on diesel engines with his dad. When he saw the giant engines, barrels pointed toward the ceiling, he could define his passion. Gulledge on GE's Team Horizon works in the renovated building where the walls are painted white under new LED lights, the new standard, Bradley says. To compete on talent, he wants recruits to know it's not the stereotypical dusty factory, but an innovative, state-of-the-art complex. This is a new Durham, Bradley says. And it's a place where employees, even new recruits, make decisions about an engine's construction. It's freedom, ownership, explains 14-year GE veteran Mark Gowland. We run our own business, time off everything. We control it. The crews work out the process, from how the order parts are unloaded to which will be placed on the barrel first. It requires painstaking documentation and carefully controlled experimentation because the stakes are higher than the growing backlog, technician Ricky Hill says. It's about the lives the planes will one day carry from place to place. And not everyone is a good fit for the rigorous culture, Hill says. It's easy to get 200 applications, but it's difficult to get 10 members we want to work here, he says. We try to have the best. With the increase in workload, GE has been doing plenty of hiring in Durham. It has about 400 overall badged employees and 150 contractors, Bradley says. More than 20 new hires start in October alone, all hired by their fellow technicians. For each job opening, 200 will apply the first week, he says. Out of 50 people we talk to, maybe 25 will pass a phone screening. Then we'll bring them in for a full-day assessment, Bradley says. Pressure is mounting to fill the lines. As of this summer, GE Aviation had made about 200 LEAP engines in Durham. We need to get to a rate of 600 a year by next year, Bradley says. Failure would set back both GE Aviation and Boeing. It's just not an option, he says. Officials say they count on GE Aviation's success to recruit additional aerospace business to North Carolina. John Boyd, a New Jersey-based site selection consultant with the Boyd Group, says the success of a firm such as GE Aviation can signal more investment by like-minded firms. He points to the precedent set by the auto industry, specifically the Toyota-Mazda operation that picked Alabama over North Carolina due to the presence of suppliers. It makes it easier to grow, he says. Alan Thomas, director of the state-owned Global Transpark, says that even though Bradley's operation is hours from Kinston, it still uses leverage when showcasing the park to investors. We look at this as a statewide effort, he says. Bradley says success in Durham helps the state's case in securing more investment from GE Aviation, too. Chris Chong, the CEO of the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, says competition for additional investments from the company have been fierce. That's because, unlike automakers, the aerospace supply chain can be global, meaning a plant doesn't have to be in proximity to another GE footprint to play into its network. When we compete to get a GE expansion, it's not even like we're competing with Virginia or South Carolina, he says. We're competing with GE's global manufacturing footprint. To lure more GE investment and aerospace investment in general, Chung says, we always have to make sure we've got a competitive business climate, and incentives can play a role in that decision. So can success in Durham, he says. That story can be leveraged for projects statewide. Today, it's a bustling shop by day, the high-tech equipment interrupted by the occasional American flag hung for motivation. Before the engine operation opened here 25 years ago, it was a vacant space. Its story is another reason economic developers take inventory of the state's unused factories, scrambling for ideas to repurpose them. This place was built in the late 60s, Bradley explains, pointing to a monorail that lines the outside of the building, whose purpose has been forgotten for decades. The factory originally pushed out steam turbines, part of GE's power division. Business was booming, and the size of the structures still at the site attest to the success of that industry. But by the early 1980s, the market was changing. GE made a decision that would rock the Bull City, to move the business from Durham. These buildings sat empty for 10 years, Bradley says. Then in the 1990s, CEO Welch put his GE team on a site selection mission to find a place where a new jet engine, the GE90, could be launched. Jack said, "I have a lot of empty rooftops. Come back with a location," Bradley says. One of the teams pitched Durham and this location, and Jack loved it. GE's current Durham plant opened in 1993. Bradley, a 20-year GE vet, has spent time with the company all over the world. He spent 3 years in England and served stints in Ohio, Indiana, and Texas. And he unsuccessfully competed for the top job in Durham years ago. When he was finally asked to come to Durham, however, I said no. Bradley says he and his family, a wife and four boys, wanted to go back to GE's home turf of Cincinnati, but the plant finally lured him to North Carolina. "This is a crown jewel," he says, "of the facility. Of the 80 plants worldwide, this is the one people want to run," he says. "I was always hungry for it. It just didn't fit into my life plan. But life takes a lot of turns." While Research Triangle Park houses visible innovators just miles away, "I bet so many out there don't know we're back here," he says. "And they don't know that's probably powering that metal tube they're taking as they take off into the sky. It's probably made right here." "It feels good," says 20-year veteran Jeff Wright. "As Gowan, your ego swells a little bit." Now we turn to this week's executive voice, and that voice belongs to Harry Chalker. PMC Commercial Interiors is in the business of creating and reimagining commercial spaces for its clients, and its CEO, Harry Chalker, has the responsibility of leading that business and its team. In fact, PMC in itself is a reimagined business. Its roots go back to 1945, when it was referred to as Raleigh Office Supply. In 2001, Price Modern purchased Raleigh Office Supply and began expanding from one Raleigh location with about 12 employees to six locations that collectively employ 135. Four legacy employees still remain. Now the Marshall-based company, a multiple winner of Triangle Business Journal's Fast 50 Awards, focuses on providing commercial furniture, architectural products, collaborative technologies, ideation, and related services. TBJ caught up with Chalker to learn about the company's growth under his leadership. So here's the Q&A with Chalker. "How long have you been involved with the company?" "I joined Price Modern in 2002 as president of the Raleigh location, with an agreement to transition ownership over time. We began marketing the company as Price Modern Carolina in 2008, and in 2011, the ownership transition from Price Modern was complete. At that point, we became PMC Commercial Interiors. When we acquired our Charlotte location in 2013, we promoted Yvette Coppedge to president of PMC Raleigh, and I took on the role as CEO. Altogether, it has been 16 incredible years." "So what did you do prior to joining PMC?" "After college, I spent 18 months with Pepsi and then transitioned my career to commercial or contract furniture. Since 1994, I've held various leadership positions in the commercial furniture industry. In 1998, we moved to Raleigh, and for 4 years, I was a sales leader for a local competitor." "What are you seeing in the marketplace now as far as design trends?" "Not necessarily new to us, but probably new to others. Less hierarchy of individual workspace, variety of workspace, balance of focus and collaboration, emphasis in well-being from ergonomics to amenity spaces like quiet rooms and yoga rooms, ubiquitous technology that is simple and easily accessible. Outdoor spaces. Residential influence in terms of comfort, materiality, and aesthetic. The fundamental driver to most of the trends is the desire to innovate. People innovate. Space attracts them, keeps them, and can foster or inhibit innovation. So how do you see those current trends evolving in the next decade? As the millennial generation begins to dominate the workforce in the next decade, work will continue to happen anywhere, at any time. Technology will be easier, faster, and more plentiful. Residential influences of comfort and familiarity will continue to flourish. Well-being amenities and community involvement will be imperative to attract new talent. The quest for innovation will transcend, and companies will consider workplace strategies as a way to leverage innovation. So what should companies consider when relocating, expanding, or simply redesigning their space? Design not just for today, but for tomorrow. The need for change will occur within months. Space solutions should be easily adaptable. Design space to align with and strengthen your organization culture. Employees will be engaged, loyal, and productive. Get your team, that's the design firm, project management firm, and furniture provider, together early and lean on each for their expertise. I think the notion of one-stop shop leaves too much knowledge out of the process. Further, if you engage your provider late in the process, you will miss their unique insight, and the result will not be as successful as it could have been. So what are the most requested amenities in new offices? Daylight and views. Better collaborative technology. Height-adjustable desks. Social hub and cafe spaces. What's the best advice you've ever been given, and who gave it? Love one another. I think we all know who came up with that one. What do you do to relax? Cindy and I like doing more than relaxing. Swimming, biking, walking, golfing, traveling, chasing our kids around, getting together with our family and friends. And finally, what books are currently on your nightstand? Arts Principles and Getting to Us. Now from the small business page comes the article written by Jim Verdonik entitled, Businesses Must Prepare to Face Risks. Recent events in the headlines remind us that life is about risk, and how we deal with risk is the biggest single determinant of success or failure in every human endeavor. Some examples from the past several weeks include Hurricane Florence. Risk brought lots of personal tragedies. Elon Musk prosecuted by the SEC for fraud in his going public statements. And the Christine Blasey Ford Brett Kavanaugh fiasco illustrates that risk can bite us in our everyday lives when we least expect it. Some risks are predictable. You can prepare, but not always. Having the right stuff determines how you deal with surprises. So how do you deal with risk? Avoidance? The problem with adopting risk avoidance as your primary strategy is that opportunities and risk hang out together. If you avoid one, you avoid the other. Lawyers tend to be notoriously risk-averse. Following legal advice often causes businesses to lose opportunities. How averse to risk is your lawyer? What about opportunity enhancement? If you fully capitalize on your opportunities, you'll have the resources to effectively deal with risks. If you don't capitalize on your opportunities, you won't create anything to lose. I call this the Silicon Valley risk strategy. Diversification. Create multiple revenue streams and invest in many types of resources. If one goes south, you can rely on the others. But how do you excel at everything? It's hard enough to be the best at one thing. The best win rewards in the marketplace. What about focus? Identify what you do best, and don't be tempted to spread into areas where you can't be the best. This approach reduces risk and maximizes opportunities because the market rewards people and businesses that demonstrate they are the best. But don't confuse focus with staying the same. Change is inevitable, so you must refine your focus to stay the best. How about depth? Have multiple people who can effectively deal with risk before and after they arise. Have more money than you think you will need. These are great strategies if you can afford it. Finally, training. The military has a saying, train the way you fight, fight the way you train. Training is how you actually implement planning. It's the only way to assure effective responses to sudden crisis situations. So you know you can't control when risk will bite you. What are you doing about it? Now we approach the viewpoint page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And as you know, there's always a guest column. This week's guest column is written by Lee Roberts, who's a former budget director for North Carolina, currently managing partner of Sharpview Capital in Raleigh. And his article is entitled, When Will the Triangle Look Like Charlotte? After a trip to Charlotte, Triangle residents often come back asking when Raleigh will look like the Queen City. We have similar levels of explosive growth, but when will we have landmark office towers, a downtown NFL stadium, and a light rail system? When will we have the same kind of vibrant central business district with thousands of office workers spilling onto the sidewalks for a sandwich at lunch and a beer after work? My answer, don't hold your breath. Despite a boom driven by many of the same factors as the growth in Charlotte, the structure of the triangle is far different. In my view, if you want to know what the triangle of the future will look like, look to Silicon Valley. The triangle shares more characteristics with the western capital of technology than it does with the southern capital of banking. Start with the employment base. Among the largest private employers in Charlotte are Wells Fargo, Bank of America, and Duke Energy. These employers offer not only high-paying jobs, but the kinds of employers that have, at least historically, house their employees in large office towers in downtown business districts. And here in the Triangle, our biggest private employer is Duke University, a well-paying nonprofit organization to be sure, but a nonprofit nonetheless, and perhaps more importantly, an employer with a workforce spread widely across multiple low-density locations. The same could be said for another of our largest employers, RTI International. The biggest for-profit employers are different also. For every Red Hat or Citrix that's chosen an urban setting, there are many more, SAS, Cisco, Fidelity, Cree, or Lenovo, all in suburban campus locations that many Triangle residents would be hard-pressed to find. While this is changing as some employers seek the vibrancy of urban clusters to attract and retain younger professionals, that still doesn't mean that we will develop a traditional hub-and-spoke commuting pattern like Charlotte. But as I see it, that's a good thing. Already an employer who wants a walkable live-work-play location with food and entertainment options can choose from at least a half dozen submarkets around the area, which makes the task of designing a light rail system that actually alleviates congestion much more difficult. We don't, and likely won't, have a dominant commuting pattern that can be addressed by a linear rail line as Charlotte does. To the extent that we do have an identical pattern, as anyone who drives I-40 knows, it's into and out of RTP. From both sides of the triangle. But where could a light rail station be located in RTP that would be walkable for any meaningful number of employees? Because there isn't one, trams or some other vehicle will need to get folks to their actual offices. In his seminal book, The New Geography of Jobs, economist Enrico Moretti writes glowingly of the long-term prospects for both the triangle and Silicon Valley. He notes that there is actually not much to see in the cradle of global tech innovation. The San Jose metro area is made up mostly of parking lots, corporate campuses, and a few sterile-looking glass towers surrounded by an ocean of single-family homes. The city has been trying to redevelop its downtown and turn it into a more pedestrian-friendly destination, but it's an uphill battle. That was published 6 years ago. And the Valley and the Triangle have both made impressive strides in creating more walkable, lively urban centers since then. And they're only getting better. One can live, work, and play in downtown Raleigh, or in North Hills, or in downtown Durham, or in Chapel Hill. Soon it will be possible in Central Cary, too, and perhaps in RTP in Pittsburgh. Silicon Valley similarly has cities in California such as San Jose, Cupertino, Mountain View, Palo Alto, and Menlo Park. So rather with comparing ourselves with Charlotte, I believe the Triangle has different strengths to embrace. With multiple submarkets instead of one urban core, each will become more dense and continue to develop greater options for workers, residents, and entertainment. It won't be Charlotte, and will be fun and fruitful to live here while it happens. Now we come to the editor's notebook for this week's Triangle Business Journal, and the editor's title column is entitled, After Uber and Airbnb, Now Comes Electric Scooters. Just a month ago, following the footsteps of San Francisco, the city of Los Angeles approved a series of regulations for a one-year pilot program for dockless electric scooters, which included a cap of 3,000 motorized scooters per company within the city limits. Scooter companies such as Lime, Bird, Lyft, and Uber's Jump knew it was a matter of time before municipalities cracked down after complaints of littered scooters on streets and sidewalks. Municipalities argue that if these ride-sharing companies will use public sidewalks and roads, they need to abide by certain traffic rules to serve the greater public good. Looking at both sides, one can make convincing arguments. Proponents and critics have valid points. Proponents of dockless electric scooters argue that they're taking cars off the streets, meaning it has an environmental benefit as well. Critics argue the scooters are safety hazards, with hospitals reporting more and more accidents, and the public right-of-ways are becoming compromised as riders leave these scooters anywhere they want. So, what's the solution? Before we get there, let's make sure the people voting on these regulations believe in one primary principle. Change is inevitable. Innovation disrupts life and the way we do things. Companies such as Uber and Airbnb have proved that. While taxing entities is necessary in many instances, banning these sharing services is not an option anymore. For electric scooters, progressive cities such as Raleigh and Durham should forget about banning these vehicles. Not an option. The only option is how to regulate them. Could you force developers to build docking stations in front of their new building? Perhaps. Could you designate areas in the central business district where folks can leave these bikes? Perhaps. It sort of defeats the purpose of mobility, but if these designated spaces are in every block, perhaps it could be compromised. Could you force these scooter companies to penalize riders with a stiff fee if they leave the scooters illegally on sidewalks? Absolutely. While that may thwart flexibility, rules and regulations need to start somewhere. I've already heard many residents are not happy with these electric scooters being left on sidewalks. When asked if they've ever used one, most say no, but say their kids or grandkids have used them when out of town. Raleigh already has indicated it wants to regulate dockless electric scooters. Before the City Council votes and decides on the fate of these scooters, the members should be aware of the changing demographic and the makeup of our future leaders. Not to mention, they need to be aware of Amazon, Apple, and other global companies. While they don't drop bikes on streets, they drop jobs on communities. Change is here. Embrace it. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be certain to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Once again, that's 919-832-5138.